Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, and I am here today to talk about a new book on an old debt crisis that has a lot of lessons we can learn for the debt crises that have come since and that may, alas, come in the future. The author of this book with us is Professor Jérôme Serre from Sciences Po, joining us from Paris. And as our discussant, we are lucky to have Paul Bluestein joining us from Japan. Paul's most recent book is about the U.S.-China relationship. It's called Schism. And he also was a journalist during the 80s debt crisis. And I'm looking forward to hearing both of you discuss how it can go. So, Jérôme, tell us about your book. What is it called? What period? What are the main historical points you're trying to make? And what are we learning about them now?
Well, the first thing probably is that this crisis was very much talked about in the 1980s, not just in the country that were stricken by the crisis, first of all, Latin America, but also in developed country, industrialized OECD country. But then by 1991, 1992, it was over. And there's been pretty little interest in it. If you look for recent references, some books, of course, come back on it, but one or two chapter, you have the official history of the IMF by Boston, which is a fine book, but otherwise, quite surprisingly, the whole crisis has receded in a kind of a historical no man's land, as we could say, in the sense that today practitioners of debt and financial crisis know pretty little about it. But at the same time, historians have not yet looked at it. So if you look at books and articles published since the beginning of this century, well, probably they have spent way, way more time working on the 19th century crisis of the 1920s. Than on the 80s. So I thought maybe it was time to start again a discussion on the 1980s.
And what is the name of your book and what languages is it available in?
The name of the book is very banal. It's called The Debt Crisis of the 1980s. And the subtitle is Law and Political Economy.
And then the debt crisis, you are primarily focusing on the one in Mexico or all the ones in Latin America?
In fact, I'm not following the crisis on a kind of grassroots level. I emphasize, I look in the details at the first big bang of 1982, which was a very serious crisis, which could have destroyed the whole Western banking system. So I look at that in the detail. And then I have a few episodes leading to the end of the crisis, which was the so-called Brady Plan, 1989, 1992, which at last brought the whole crisis to an end. But at the same time, it's not just a narrative book. So I don't go through the case of Argentina, the case of Brazil, and so on. I have references here and there. The whole book is also quite analytical. So I look at how the crisis was managed, how it was analyzed, how it was eventually resolved, how the IMF worked, which is what the subtitle alludes to, law and political economy, means I look at the rules of the game, in a sense, and the conflicts and the big patterns. And so it's also a book that is very much top-down. It's seen from the commanding heights of the global economy, seen from the IMF, the G7 countries, the US Treasury, the Federal Reserve, of course, but not much from, say, those who suffered the most from the crisis, especially in Latin America, where the memory of the crisis is still very present in these societies. But that's perspective is from the top down.
Paul, what do you remember of this period, and what are your takeaways at this stage?
Yeah, well, I was a journalist. I wasn't covering the international side of that. I was sitting with numbers of colleagues who were, and I vividly remember a legendary reporter when I was at the Wall Street Journal. I was overhearing her on long distance calls to, you know, Buenos Aires or Brasilia. Mr. Minister, are you going to be able to make, you know, your next quarterly debt payment or not? I really need a straight answer on this, you know, this guy, because the world was hanging in the balance. The international banking system, as Professor Sagard makes clear in his book, there was great fear that if any one of these countries defaulted, that the capital position of all the major financial institutions in the world, I mean, they'd be wiped out. So And, you know, occasionally I would find myself at IMF World Bank meetings where Angel Gurria, the debt negotiator for Mexico, who was a very, very tall, very charismatic, I believe he was the face of defiance, which I find kind of funny that, you know, he later became the head of the OECD. But he was a very, very capable, I mean, very, very smart, well-educated guy. And he had a mission to accomplish for his country. And he was very good at it. And he'd be walking down the halls of the, and he'd be trailed by mobs of reporters, you know, asking for the latest, you know, tidbit on how the negotiations were going. This was, of course, particularly in 1986, when Mexico slipped back into crisis, as it became the first country to go into the Brady Plan and a lot of these events that Professor Sagard covers in his book. I remember being hugely amused when I went to an IMF World Bank meeting in 1991 in Bangkok. And by then, as the professor just pointed out, you know, the crisis was pretty much over. And all anybody cared about at that point was what was happening to the Soviet Union. And the chief financial official for the Soviets, he was the one being mobbed by reporters. And I remember seeing Gurria looking rather forlorn. I mean, you know, it was a very much a good news, bad news thing for him. On the one hand, his country was out of the woods, at least at that point, of course, until 1994 when they had another crisis. But they were out of the woods at that point, but no one was paying any attention to it. So it was this, you know, the financial reporters who really understood this stuff, the attention they were paying to this was not misplaced. They weren't, I don't think, over-dramatizing, at least more than we usually do, because this was a, you know, if this had gone awry, it would have been an apocalypse now, to quote, I believe, a research paper that the Bank of England used that term as a, if one bank had declared, filed some sort of legal action of a default against one of the sovereign powers and others, the cross default clauses would have kicked in and every bank would have had to take enormous write downs. And who knows, it could have been even more serious than what happened in 2008. Who knows? Fortunately, we never got to that point.
Yeah, it was really a big test of the IMF and the Bretton Woods institutions, wasn't it, Jerome?
Yes, I think it was indeed. Possibly the IMF has never been so much at the first front of crisis management, in the sense that the IMF at the end of the day is just a multilateral, and especially one that is very close to the U.S. Treasury. And at time of crisis, the U.S. Treasury has a kind of lead over the IMF. But quite surprisingly, 1982, the IMF was in the first line, was truly, as Paul Volcker said, played a huge role at that time. That was the head of the IMF, Jacques Delarosière, who was the orchestra director, as he says. And that was due to the context of those years, that the Reagan administration was not a big fan of multilateral, and especially the U.S. Treasury secretary. And in a sense, he stayed put at the beginning. 1982, he said, well, I will not mess around. I will allow you to do what you need to do, but please go forward. And so that was quite a unique case where both the U.S. Treasury was on the back foot, and in a sense, the IMF, in close alliance with the Fed, was allowed to take the first roles. In a sense, it's a kind of a high point of classic IMF policymaking and crisis management. Probably has never been so much in the first front of crisis management than 1982.
The threat of default from Latin America was still hanging around when I started writing about Treasury and the IMF in the late 90s and the early 2000s. And it seems like it was with us almost until the beginning of the euro crisis. And then, as we heard, it sort of faded back and now people are talking about it again. What patterns do you see repeating, Jerome? What can we be learning now?
Well, I think there are lots of convergences. At the same time, the whole context had changed hugely. To start with, the preeminence of the US and therefore of the IMF is not at all as clear today. Today, a country like Venezuela or Argentina in the past years has a problem of foreign financing, while it can go to China. And China now regularly lends to countries that would have gone to the IMF 20 years ago. Another dimension is that you can draw countries to the courts, to US courts. And that changes completely the rules of the game, in the sense that creditors have this now very powerful tool of litigating, which was not at all on the map in the 1980s. So in a sense, the 1980s looked at, from that perspective, much more like post-war decades regime than what we had today, even though the basic issue in case of a sovereign default are still there. Coordination, short-term intervention, how to negotiate the write-off, how to have everybody on board, and so on.
Paul, how do you see the addition of China on the global financial scene affecting these trends?
I mean, China, as the professor just said, has, you know, kind of thrown a lifeline to some countries, but that has, not, once things have gone sour, then it really throws a monkey wrench into the whole situation, because normally when countries, particularly the sub-Saharan African countries that have borrowed heavily from China, once they get into trouble and need to renegotiate their debts, the Chinese are not willing to participate in what's called the Paris Club, the group of creditor governments. It's not willing to subordinate, it's not willing to play along in many cases with private creditors, the big bondholders and so forth, who are maybe willing to negotiate a debt restructuring. Now, we've just seen recently that there's been some reports which sound very hopeful that the Chinese government and U.S. Treasury are discussing some kind of plan to overcome some of these sort of ructions or one of these structural problems in the whole international debt situation. But, you know, Chinese capital has certainly been a blessing for some of these countries. It's helped them develop. There is some positive impact. But the Chinese say our big banks, our big state-owned banks are not subject to some of the same rules as your banks and your private financial institutions. And this creates all kinds of difficulties for negotiations. So one would have hoped that after the resolution of the Argentine debt problem, which, you know, another country that had run into trouble in the 1980s and then ran into trouble again, there's a book I wrote about, but not about what happened in the 1980s, but what happened in 2001. And it took 15, close to 20 years to get Argentina out of the mess that it was in, at least as far as its debt goes. And one would have hoped that the resolution of that might have provided a framework for resolving a lot of the other problems that have arisen in a lot of developing countries since then. But because of the Chinese role, the situation is very murky and difficult to resolve.
It's so interesting to me hearing you both talk, just listening to the iterative nature of these crises. We had the post-war institutions lingering all the way to the 1980s. Then we had this transition period in the 90s where some of the same countries were involved, but the dynamics hadn't really changed. China becomes involved as a new investor country, which helps. It takes the pressure off the West. But then China also becomes a creditor country, and we're back to talking about write-downs again. So it's a spiral, if not a circle. When we come back in the next section, we'll talk more about what actually happened in the 80s. Welcome back. Jerome, can you help listeners understand exactly what happened starting in 1982 and working through to the resolution of this crisis?
Well, I think, in fact, when you got a crisis, the first question you have is what happened before? How can this international banking system find itself 1982 in a very serious quasi-systemic crisis where, as Paul Bluestein said a minute ago, could have destroyed the whole banking system? And what you see before, say from the second oil shock 1973 and over a decade, is probably the most flawed international lending cycle in history. If you look at the 19th century broadly, well, they got crisis, but the same rules apply from the 1820s to the First World War. And today we don't have very stable rules, but about we know where they stand. 1970s, you got a cycle of 10 years and entirely collapsed. So 1982, we've been talking about with Mexico, was the realization that you had enormous amount of debt that's been lent across developing countries on extremely weak basis. Very poor information, very poor statistics, very poor expertise on what was happening on the ground, and bad contract structures for the debt itself. So in 1982, there was this big threat. After Mexico, you had about 35 countries following on. So it was not just Mexico. Mexico was the really dangerous moment. But then you had to address a lot of other countries. So broadly speaking, then you had three big moments. First, you have, let's say, standard IMF program, 82-85, the usual way for the IMF to do it. You slam on the brakes, you rebalance public finances, be serious with money and exchange rate. And hopefully, capital will flow back into the country and growth will come back. It works sometimes, but it didn't work in the 80s. So you find yourself 85, 86, with country that has been adjusted, but were not able to go back into the market, could not completely stabilize and recover. So at that moment, you had a very serious economic discussion. What's going on here? Why is it that it doesn't work? And the first answer that was proposed, called the Baker Plan, after the name of the then Secretary to the Treasury in the US, was essentially the invention of the Washington Consensus. Macroeconomic stabilization, that means fiscal monetary exchange rate, didn't work. So let's look at the supply side. Let's privatize. Let's open trade, open the country to foreign trade. Let's flexibilize the labor market. So truly the beginning of the Washington Consensus, 1985-86, with the so-called Baker Plan. And that had a long future. At the same time, the Baker Plan did not resolve the problem. So you find yourself again, 88, early in 89, having to find another solution, a third plan in a sense. And that was a successful one, called the Brady Plan, after the name of another US Treasury Secretary, Brady. And the Brady Plan, of course, leaned on structural adjustment and all that. Also, it, for the first time since 8-7 years, gave write-offs. I mean, all countries received substantial haircuts, as they say, on their debt, which was a big break vis-a-vis the U.S. policy of the previous years. And quite remarkably, at the same time, all the big stocks of all debt going back to the 1970s were first cut by 15, 20, 40%, and almost overnight exchanged against bonds. Before that, you had loans kept by banks only. Overnight, you find yourself in a disintermediated bond-based sovereign debt market, which become extraordinarily powerful and liquid and dynamic. And so you have both a kind of quantitative dimension of write-off and also literally throwing this country in the now rapidly growing global capital markets. So here you have a direct link between the resolution of the debt crisis and the move to emerging markets, global capital markets, and so on. And that's a third moment, quite successful one, at least as regard debt sustainability, forgetting about the bad 1980s. While the country grew much better afterwards, or become more stable economically, is another question.
It's so interesting to me to hear some of these names, James Baker, Nick Brady, revisiting that period of American history, and also a time when foreign exchange rates were so much in the news. In the euro area, we forget what it's like borrowing outside your currency and having that risk on top of other credit issues. Paul, how do you see this evolution over the last couple of decades? What did it mean then, and where are we now?
Yeah, I was particularly fascinated by the point that the professor was making about how the debt markets switched from bank loans, syndicated bank loans, to bonds, because I think that's in many ways the even bigger, more crucial factor in looking at the sort of broad sweep of what the meaning of that crisis is and what lessons can be taken. Because look at how difficult it was to resolve that crisis in the 1980s. There you had situations where banks, CEOs or senior vice presidents, you know, the top executives of big banks were called on the, really hauled almost by the scruffs, figuratively, of course, by the scruffs of their necks, into meetings in 1982, famously with Lavoisier at the IMF. But although the meeting took place in the New York Federal Reserve down in Wall Street, and they were told, you know, you are going to have to put up more money, whether you like it or not. You know, you're going to have to throw good money after bad here. There's a risk, but this is the only way we're going to get out of here. We're going to get out of this, or else or else it's going to be apocalypse now. And it worked. It kept the crisis from becoming much worse than it was, but it didn't work in resolving the crisis. It took until the Brady Plan of 88 and 89 before these countries really began to overcome the problems that they'd encountered. But once international lending switched from countries borrowing from banks to borrowing on the bond markets, you had a whole new ball game, because now you had, instead of, 300, 500 banks who had lent to one of these big countries, who you could call, 10 or 20 of the biggest banks into the room and push them around, and then they would go push around the smaller banks. And if that didn't work, then you'd get the regulators in those countries to bully the little banks into submission, then these big banking syndicates that had lent to countries. Once it became the capital market switched to bond financing, then you really had a problem of herding cats. You had tens of thousands, millions of individual securities that, where countries owed interest and principal on. This is how you ran into the problem with Argentina and later with Greece and with other countries. Peru was one of the first famous examples where individual bondholders would sue, as another thing the press alluded to, basically hold out and demand full payment, even though, they might have bought the bonds at 25 cents on the dollar in the market. They were going to say, this bond indenture entitles me to full payment plus interest. So the whole dynamic, really changed once you had to deal with these vast numbers of investors all over the world that had lent money to these countries. And it really is interesting to look back on debt crisis of the 80s, as Professor Sigard has done, and see how intractable it was for such a long time, and realize that how much more difficult it later became when global capital markets really exploded. But there were precedents set during the 1980s that did end up playing some role in both overcoming and making difficult the resolution of later debt crises.
Jérôme, would you like to add anything to that?
Yeah, I think Paul is absolutely right to underline how difficult it is today to herd cats. I mean, take again the classic example of Argentina. 2002, 2005, you had high-tech hedge funds. You had big conservative banks like Deutsche Bank or BNP or others. But you also had literally tens of thousands of Italian pensioners who have been told, wow, Italian T-bills with the move to euro are now, do not earn you a lot of money today. Just buy Argentine T-bills. That will earn you as much as Italian 1 year ago. And then they ended up in a default with their pension there. So how do you coordinate those guys? It's extremely difficult, especially as they can sell and buy. They can be around the table today, but the morning after they are left the room because they sold out the bonds. So it's become much more technically hard to coordinate. At the same time, as Paul also said, things were quite difficult in the 80s when you had just 300 or 600 banks. I mean, there has been a constant fight, whereas Paul alluded to, but is not very much present in the literature, is how much central banks across OECD countries has been arm-twisting banks in a highly unpleasant way. That was really coercion. That's something you could not do today, and looks very much like post-war decades, hands-on, heavy-handed intervention. But at the same time, you had a lot of resistance within OECD countries. I mean, the Swiss, the Germans, the Dutch, up to a point the English, were completely upset by what they were expected to do. But they did it till the end. Even the successful Brady Plan 1989-92, well, they had the banks again had to be arm twisted. And so they had the bad memories of that, which probably is another reason why everybody forgot about this unpleasant experience in the following years.
That is a really interesting point, back when the government would twist the arms of these banks to be more constructive, because certainly right now the debate has shifted to talking about too big to fail and how to take them apart, to unwind them, as opposed to just bear down on them and get them to toe the line and cooperate. When we come back, we'll talk about how we got out of the 80s debt crisis. We'll be right back. As we wrap up this podcast, Jérôme, how did they get out of it in the end? How did they get to an end game?
Well, the usual way of interpreting has been summarizing one catchword, which has debt overhang, which is a word that emerged in 86, 87 from the academia. You had people like Jeffrey Sachs, Paul Krugman saying, well, in fact, the IMF first cycle of adjustment did not work because the debt is just too big. You don't keep enough resources domestically to invest and recover. So you have to cut the debt. And the expectation was the day you write off, at last countries will be able to invest, rebuild their export sector, their infrastructure, and growth will soon be there. But in fact, when you look at the data, macroeconomic data from Latin American countries from the first half or the whole of the 1990s, you don't see that happening. Investment rate did not increase widely. Debt levels sometimes some country remained low. In other countries, they picked up quite rapidly, and they had another default, like Argentina, we have been talking about, or Peru. Or if you look at trade opening or growth, well, the first year post write-off were fine, but then you had other crises. So you don't have a clear scenario of at last those countries getting rid of their big overload of debt and doing nicely. No, not that much, in fact. So I suggest it's hard to kind of demonstrate formally things, but I think that most of the dynamic was the one I associated was this immediate entry into global capital markets, that suddenly liquidity flowed into the countries, lots of investors were happy to come in, banks were much more cautious and remained on the side, and so money flowed in. Countries find themselves better off than in the 1980s, but that was way more fragile than expected. So 1994, 1995, you got, again, a crisis, first in Mexico, with contagion across the continent. So my reading of the way out of the crisis is much more cautious or skeptical than the classic view that the write-off were the key elements. Probably they just find a way to attract new fresh capital through move to the bond market than radically changing how this economy were working. And are still saddled today with quite similar problem, small export sector, small saving rates, fragile domestic finance. Situation is not that massively different today.
That was your Argentina book, right, Paul? The money kept rolling in and rolling out.
Yeah, that really was the story of Argentina in the 90s. They got a Brady deal, that is, they got a write-off of their bank debt, and they got a whole new monetary policy in the form of the convertibility plan, which rigidly linked the peso to the U.S. dollar. And for a while, they were doing splendidly. Inflation came way, way down, and the country embraced a lot of the Washington consensus. And they were the darling of the IMF, and they sailed through early years of the Asian financial crisis. The IMF even invited President Menem, the Argentine president, to the IMF World Bank meetings in Washington in 1998, basically to say, look, do what this guy does, and countries in the developing world, you'll all be fine. And but then 3 years later, Argentina underwent one of the worst crises that any country has ever undergone, wrenching, you know, basically depression level unemployment and rises in poverty and so forth, for a whole bunch of reasons, which we won't get into because this is about Jerome's book, not mine. But yeah, the banks pretty much got out of Argentina. They'd been burned, and they did do a fair amount of lending to South Korea, which had a crisis of its own in the late 90s. But it was bonds that financed this huge boom in Argentina in the 90s until it went bad. So working out a way out of that crisis, there were some terrible cat herding problems that arose because the whole financial system had changed from bank lending, as difficult as that was, and Jerome's book certainly shows it, it became even tougher.
This transition from banks at the center of the financial system to capital markets, and then the ways that the capital markets have grown and evolved, that's so important for where we are today and how we approach financial stability going forward. Jérôme, as we close out this podcast, do you have any takeaways for people trying to navigate that now, or the two things you wish people would learn from your book?
Well, the first thing probably we have been discussing is, at time of crisis, everybody wants to get out. everybody wants to take its pot of money and run away with it. So the kind of first rule and first challenge of crisis manager is how to get everybody around the table. And in the case of the 80s, being strong enough to arm twist the bank and say, you guys, you stay around the table and you add new money to help the country. Today, that's way more difficult. The other elements, I think, is something that takes us back to the IMF. When do you decide and how do you decide the country deserves a write-off? Today, some people say, well, if you had given a write-off already 82, 83 to Mexico and the others, the crisis would have been over in 3 years and we won't, would not talk about it. But that's not so easy. If you take a, if you give a write-off easily, well, banks will not lend anymore. So you have to find a balance between the interest of the bank or the lenders or the capital markets, even if they are not all of them nice people, and at the same time, the interest of the country at a point, which may at a point need a write-off. So how do you decide that? Who is the judge of peace here, or the peace judge? Should it be the US government, like in the 1980s, when Brady was the one to decide, now we can't go on this way, we have to accept the write-off? Or should it be the IMF? But IMF is also a political institution. So who should do that? And with which criteria? Avoiding at the same time to give so-called free lunch, allowing country to move out of debt too easily, or on the other hand, avoiding the long, painful years of the 1980s, where country had been struggling through the crisis for 7 years. So the challenge here is still with us. How you decide with which criteria and who does it?
Thank you so much for that. Thank you to both of you for walking us through the last 40 years of financial crisis and recovery. To all of our listeners, you can find out more about these authors, Professor Jérôme Scade from Sciences Po, author and journalist Paul Bluestein, who has written many books about these issues. I'm Rebecca Christie. I'm a senior fellow here at Bruegel and also the Europe columnist for Reuters Breaking Views. This show and all of our research and links to related research can be found on our website, bruegel.org. And I hope you'll join us on The Sound of Economics next time.